From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
We are speaking about the right of people to resist occupation. And this is a right, and we are not going to move from this principal position just in order to be in the Knesset. We will lose our own political identity and just be there in the Knesset as a part of the Israeli Zionist consent.
Israel's Knesset votes to revoke immunity from popular Palestinian member of parliament, Azmi Bashara. He can now be prosecuted for publicly supporting Palestinian resistance. We'll speak with him in Jerusalem. The erosion of democracy, how the political right will benefit from the attacks of September 11th, and from mogul to mayor, one of the richest men in New York, multi-billionaire Michael Bloomberg, spends over $55 million of his own money to become mayor, more money than any mayoral candidate in history. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. Afghan opposition forces said today they're advancing steadily toward the key northern city of Mazar-e Sharif with the help of round-the-clock U.S. bombing. Both sides said fighting was intense south of Mazar, which the Taliban seized from the opposition Northern Alliance in 1998. The Taliban's Bakhtar news agency said U.S. jets bombed in eastern Kunar province yesterday, killing three civilians and injuring six, flattening an empty school. The White House, meanwhile, put new emphasis on the humanitarian aid it's providing Afghanistan. President Bush said after a meeting with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, quote, "We talked a lot about making sure that our great compassion for the innocents in Afghanistan is fulfilled," adding, "We must feed the people." Humanitarian groups around the world continue to plead with the U.S. and Britain to stop bombing so that aid can be rushed to the estimated 7 million Afghans at risk of starvation in the coming months. Most of the humanitarian groups have condemned the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan. White House senior advisor Karl Rove will meet with top-level Hollywood executives on Sunday to hammer out an entertainment industry agenda for aiding the so-called war on terrorism. At the instigation of the White House, invitations were sent to Motion Picture Association of America President Jack Valenti, Viacom Entertainment CEO Jonathan Dolgan, Paramount Pictures Chair Sherry Lansing, and Rupert Murdoch. The invites subsequently went out to the owners and CEOs of the various studios and networks, most of whom quickly agreed to attend. A key figure in arranging the session was Gerald Parsky, who ran the Bush campaign in California. The press will be barred from the Sunday summit, which will take place at a Beverly Hills hotel. One executive who planned to attend the meeting likened the effort to those that followed Pearl Harbor, but insisted Hollywood can contribute in positive ways without becoming a propaganda organ. In related news, the U.S. House of Representatives yesterday, by a near unanimous vote, approved a measure to establish a radio-free Afghanistan to broadcast news and explain U.S. war aims to Afghans in their local languages. Supporters say the broadcasts, which cannot be aired in the U.S. since they constitute state propaganda, are needed to get the truth to the Afghan people. Some lawmakers have been critical of the Voice of America, which purports to offer straightforward news, for not advocating the U.S. position forcefully enough. Congressmember Joseph Huffel, a Pennsylvania Democrat, said, quote, "We must blanket the people of Afghanistan with the voice of freedom, truth, and democracy as we blanket the Taliban with bombs." Italy has announced it's providing a force of 2,700 troops to join the U.S.-led military operation against Afghanistan. Italian Defense Minister Antonio Martino told Parliament the force would include naval, air, and ground units. Parliament expressed wide approval for the decision, with only the Communist and Green parties dissenting. The announcement came as the German cabinet approved Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder's pledge yesterday to provide a force of nearly 4,000 troops at the request of the U.S. Schroeder called the decision historic and a reversal of the country's post-war stance against military involvement outside the region. Germany countries offering the U.S. armored personnel, airborne medical evacuation units, and members of Germany's elite special forces, which could engage in ground operations. The German government decision creates serious dilemma for the Greens, the Chancellor Schroeder's junior coalition partners. A majority in the Green Party have called for a pause in the bombing so that humanitarian aid can be delivered during Ramadan, a view held by an outright majority of the German population. After weeks of frequent, often tumultuous briefings by Taliban officials, Pakistan's government this week formally asked Taliban diplomats to stop holding news conferences at their embassy to denounce U.S. military attacks. The request reportedly followed complaints from U.S. officials about the briefings on the embassy lawn, at which Taliban envoys describe U.S. bombs hitting hospitals and schools, defended Osama bin Laden, and claimed the United States was using chemical and biological weapons to flush him out of his Afghan redoubt. In addition, Pakistani newspapers reported that the government has clamped down on domestic broadcasts by Al Jazeera, the Qatar-based satellite TV network that's regularly broadcast video of alleged bombing damage in Afghanistan and statements by bin Laden. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson says she arrived in Beijing. She'll urge China not to use a war on terrorism to crack down on civil liberties and ethnic minorities, especially in its Muslim Northwest. China's called for international support for its campaign against the Uyghur Muslim separatists in the northwestern region of Xinjiang, whom it says have links to Osama bin Laden. But human rights groups and Western experts on Xinjiang say most Uyghur activists are simply campaigning peacefully for greater political, economic, and religious freedoms. Amnesty International has said China's executed several hundred Uyghurs accused of separatist activities since the mid-1990s and detained, imprisoned, or tortured thousands more. A U.S. House Finance Committee voted yesterday to guarantee government backing for the insurance industry. The legislation commits the government to paying 90% of losses from another major terrorist attack, with insurance companies paying the rest. Democrats objected to some provisions of the bill, saying the House has yet to allocate money for unemployment insurance or insurance costs for the tens of thousands of people who've lost their jobs since September 11th.
Look, look, we all witness the sweat rolling down Miss Liberty's head. She knows the sleeping giant, she's no longer sleeping dead. Oh, what a fulfillment of prophecy. Let us teach the children, freedom's never been free. It's okay to cry, go ahead and cry. 'Cause Jesus wept, but hope and faith be kept. It's a new day.
World order, a brand new day.
It's a new day.
Change your mind for the human race.
It's a new day.
World order, a brand new day.
It's a
change your mind for the human race.
The die has been cast, and there's no need to fear. 'Cause people, the answer to your prayers are here. Sister Mary, don't you weep. Tell mother not to moan.
The late, great Curtis Mayfield, The New World Order, here on Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, broadcasting just outside another police checkpoint where the Army and state troopers and police continue to stop vans, trucks, and cars. I'm Amy Goodman. As the FBI struggles to crack anthrax cases, authorities have definitely not ruled out the possibility that they may be the work of a domestic extremist group. Popular perception points to Al-Qaeda or some international organization, but with no definitive leads in the case, law enforcement officials are looking here at home. Many domestic terrorists are said to be obsessed with biological weapons, as evidenced by the hundreds of anthrax hoaxes perpetrated by right-wing groups, most often against women's health clinics. In 1995, members of the Minnesota Patriots Council, an anti-government group, were caught plotting to kill law enforcement officials with ricin, a toxin they manufactured using a kit ordered from a magazine. That same year, Larry Wayne Harris, a member of the Identity Christian Church, who Democracy Now! Spoke with just a few weeks ago, managed to order 3 vials of Yersinia pestis, which causes bubonic plague, from a laboratory in Maryland. Harris was caught and arrested, but 3 years later, police found 8 bags of what he boasted was weapons-grade anthrax in his car. The substance turned out to be anthrax vaccine. Harris's ability to acquire even a non-lethal form of anthrax and the press his actions garnered may have inspired other right-wing groups. Since 1998, the number of anthrax hoaxes sent to abortion clinics spiked sharply. Political Research Associates, a group that monitors and analyzes the political right in the U.S., has long believed that the right will capitalize on events of the time to try to limit rights for many. After September 11th, the president of Political Research Associates, Gene Hardesty, began touring the country to talk about the continued erosion of democracy. She joins us now from Massachusetts. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. So can you tell us what your main message is since September 11th? You put out a major paper just before September 11th on Rights for Some, new report targets erosion of democracy. But what about since the 11th?
Well, I would say before the 11th, what we were trying to communicate to people is that the message that the right puts out, that it is the people's friend and that it is against elites and therefore somehow aligned with the average person, using a lot of the language of democracy to make its case, was completely false. And so this lengthy report lays out all of the different ways that the right is actually anti-democratic, despite its claims that it speaks for the average person, and exactly the ways in which it's anti-democratic. But I think that September 11th has shifted the ground in favor of the rights agenda to an alarming degree, and I would say in several different areas, most of which are quite obvious, I think. It certainly has silenced the Democratic opposition, so that something like the USA Patriot Act could go through Congress with barely a whimper of opposition, despite the fact that it violates, by my count, and I'm not a lawyer, 5 different amendments to the Constitution.
Explain that act again.
That's the anti-terrorism bill that we've just seen go through that has the most amazing things that can be done to people. For instance, especially, of course, it targets non-citizens, but it also targets anyone who is demonstrating. For instance, I'll read you a provision. Any protest or assembly can be designated an act of domestic terrorism, and any protester can be treated as a terrorist with extreme penalties. Now, this is the sort of thing that you can only get through in this country if you have declared a war and you've frightened people to death. And I can promise you that there will be abuses under this anti-terrorism bill. But that's not the only thing going on. I think there are a lot of eyes watching how the anti-terrorism bill is implemented and how its provisions disproportionately affect people of color and people to the left of center. The other thing that's going on is the Bush administration's attempt to defund the government, what the right calls starve the beast, through tax cuts that have already depleted the surplus that we had and will finish off the surplus in the next round called the economic stimulus package that's now going through Congress as we speak. Add to that funding the military, and I think that the right under the Bush administration, which really is an administration that unites all the sectors of the right under one umbrella, I think that we'll find that they will have, with enormous speed, accomplished their agenda, which was stated during the Bush campaign, that we are going to Washington to limit government, to trim government down to its barest minimum. And then finally, I think the patriotism and some people would say jingoism that's being aroused by September 11th. In the face of this tragedy, we're seeing a lot of use of slogans and use of fear to encourage in people a respect for authority, which is also a right-wing agenda, that in fact you don't speak out, you unite, you become true Americans and real Americans, and that opens up a whole area of potential scapegoating of anyone who is against the war, who questions U.S. foreign policy, either past or present. And I think that that's another part of silencing liberalism and progressivism in this country.
Let's talk about that, Jean Hardesty, the silencing of dissent right now. How extreme do you think it is?
Well, I think it comes from two sources, and one is very easy to sympathize with. I do myself. You know, you're afraid that if you don't support the government at this point, that somehow you are showing a lack of sympathy and understanding for the tragic events of September 11th, as if they were nothing to you as an American. You're going back to business as usual, protesting what your government is doing. But I think that the other problem is that the American people are so united now behind George Bush that politicians are afraid to speak out. And we saw for those 8 years that Bill Clinton was in office how highly organized the right can be to attack anyone who takes a position that they don't agree with. So I think Barbara Lee and her vote was almost exactly the kind of example that I'm referring to. She has been viciously attacked since she voted against giving Bush unlimited powers to conduct the war. And this doesn't come out of sort of random people expressing their First Amendment rights to protest her vote. It comes from an organized movement that for years has developed a highly toned and refined system of attacking a politician it doesn't agree with.
What about the investigation of the anthrax cases? Of course, the first messages that were being put out, like with the bombing of the Oklahoma City building years ago, is that it's someone of Middle Eastern descent. Mm-hmm. But then even the Bush administration was saying they're looking at home at right-wing groups. What about that?
I think it's not a good idea to talk about something you really can't explain. I think that this could be, it certainly feels homegrown to us at Political Research Associates because we've watched the far right for 20 years now, and it feels as if it has, the targets are right for the far right. But I think that we are very reluctant to say whether this is domestic or not, or international, or some collaboration between domestic and international. I think that the fear that anthrax has aroused has had very much the same effect that the bombing of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon had. That is that it has frightened people into approving of almost anything that the government wants to do to anybody that it has the slightest suspicion of.
There's a large piece in the New York Times of last Sunday that has a chart, about a quarter of a page, of the agencies within the U.S. government that Tom Ridge is coordinating, the new director of Homeland Security. First, I was wondering how just the ring of Homeland Security sounds to you. But then the appointments that President Bush has made to his administration, many veterans of previous U.S. wars, both overt and covert, and the roles that they have played in the past and will play now.
Well, let's go first to that, because I think there's really a story there. The Bush administration came into office, whether that election was won by Bush or not is a separate question, but when they came into office, they had accomplished that by uniting all the different sectors of the right, and as soon as Bush took office, he started to pay back those debts. So you had John Ashcroft at Justice representing the Christian right, and Colin Powell and Christy Todd Whitman representing the moderate Republicans, and Donald Rumsfeld representing the old secular right wing. I think what's happening now is that all of those, that sort of second layer of leadership, the cabinet, have filled their departments with the ideologues that represent their particular sector. So, for instance, Tommy Thompson at HHS has filled his department with people who support a war on welfare and the trimming back of social services paid for by the government. What will happen now, while people are terribly distracted, probably as much by anthrax as they are by the war in Afghanistan, is that all of those bureaucrats nested in those government departments will now carry out their right-wing agenda, the agenda that they came with. So, for instance, when the welfare reauthorization bill comes up, the reauthorization of TANF, which replaced AFDC, it's coming up in 2002. This is extremely important for low-income people, welfare recipients, or people who will be welfare recipients because they're losing their jobs. I think we'll see inserted into that language about marriage and how marriage should accompany any kind of entry into welfare. Now, that is a right-wing agenda item that will fly completely below the radar of the average person. The same thing is true in the environmental movement. There are tremendous changes being made in regulations and rules governing the environment now, one recently on mining on federal lands, that get buried on the third page of the newspaper, and people don't realize that actually the Bush administration is carrying forth its agenda. It's just carrying it forth quietly and under the radar.
Well, Jean Hardesty, I want to thank you very much for being with us, president of Political Research Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts. If people want to see your report on the right in this country, where can they go on the web or where can they call?
www.publiceye.org.
Public Eye, that's
the name of our newsletter, our quarterly news publication.
.org.
Right.
Well, thank you for being with us, and people can always go to our website, democracynow.org, to get all the links and latest information on guests and organizations that we talk to. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll look at the mogul-turned-mayor, Michael Bloomberg. He spent more money for the race to be mayor in New York than any person in history. Stay with us.
I mean, what if there's no time to lose? What if there's things we gotta do, things that need to be said? For everything I know, I mean, you don't have to agree with me, but once you get me going, you better just let me go. I mean, we have to be able to criticize what we love, say what we have to say. Oh, if you're not trying to make something better, then as far as I can tell, you are just in the way. I mean, what if no one's watching? What if when we're dead, we are just dead? I mean, what if it's just us down here? What if God is just an idea someone put in your head? I mean, what if no one's watching? What if no one's watching? I mean, what if no one's watching? What if no one's watching? My life were a movie, there would be a
sunset and the camera would pan away. But the sky is just a little sister tagging along behind the buildings trying to imitate their gray. What if no one's watching? What if no one's watching? What if no one's watching? What if no one's watching?
You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, What If No One's Watching, Ani DeFranco, here on Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, Republican multi-billionaire media mogul Michael Bloomberg parlayed his bankroll and Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's backing to narrowly defeat Democrat Mark Green. He will be New York's 108th mayor. While he was a political novice, he built a multi-billion-dollar Manhattan-based global company. One of the questions raised now is what will he do with his controlling interest in that company? Bloomberg spent more than $55 million of his own fortune to win the right to govern a city facing the worst fiscal crisis since the 1970s. He has run in a city that is Democrat 5-1. But he won. Green faced lingering resentment among Latinos and African Americans, upset by what they considered racially divisive tactics against Bronx Borough President Fernando Ferrer in the Democratic primary runoff. Ferrer and Reverend Al Sharpton refused to speak out for Green this past week, likely costing Green crucial votes in minority neighborhoods that are Democratic strongholds. In fact, one of the first things that Michael Bloomberg did after he won the next morning, Wednesday morning, was have breakfast with Fernando Ferrer. We're joined on the telephone and in our Firehouse studio by several people to talk about this victory. We're going to begin with Les Payne, who is the managing editor of Newsday newspaper. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
Well, that's deputy managing editor.
Deputy managing editor.
Thanks for the promotion.
Anytime. You certainly deserve it. It's then higher than that. But let's start off with who Michael Bloomberg is.
We don't know a lot about him. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, we've written stories about him. I mean, he describes himself as a single straight billionaire Republican. We know him as something of a recovering Democrat, having been a Republican only for about a year now. He joined the party because he figured he would have a better chance to be the mayor. That way, he obviously, well, he's from Boston. He, as you said, is a billionaire. He spent $55 million of his own funds. We don't really know what he will do. We don't know quite enough about his style. We do know that he's a businessman. We do know that he's a self-made billionaire. But how he will govern, what his style will be, what his alliances will be. He's not beholden to an awful lot of people. I mean, an interesting thing to discover soon is what will be his relationship with the current mayor, Giuliani. Some people see this as an extension of Mayor Giuliani's influence, if not his power. But it's pretty clear, I think, that given the two egos, I don't think Mayor Giuliani would have an undue influence for too long a time. But who knows?
In fact, in your newspaper, Newsday, it described the meeting that Bloomberg had with the Democratic primary candidate, Fernando Ferrer, as much warmer than when he came over to City Hall yesterday to stand with Mayor Giuliani. And I wanted to ask Randolph Scott McLaughlin about this, professor of law at Pace University and voting rights expert, about what happened in the primary and whether you think Green torpedoed his own election with how he treated the Latino Bronx Borough president who ran against him and might have won the primary.
I think the seeds for the Green loss in the general election were sown in the primary runoff. There was no question about it. Now, Mr. Green wishes to distance himself and did try that from those who used racially divisive tactics, trying to tout Reverend Sharpton as having an undue influence over Mr. Ferrer. I think that essentially jettisoned any hope he had of winning that election. Because the one thing anyone should learn in New York City is that without a coalition built across racial lines, across economic class lines, you can't win in New York City. And in a race that was as tight as this race was, had Mr. Green not alienated the black and Hispanic voters, there would have been a greater turnout and certainly more support for him, and that vote would have put him over the top. I think that New York City, a new day has just dawned in New York City politics. Now, I just want to remind the listeners that it wasn't too long ago that blacks and Hispanics did not support the same mayoral candidates, in fact, supported different candidates. And this was the first time in the history of the city that the black and Hispanic voters coalesced behind, and the unions coalesced behind, Mr. Ferrer. And in order to destroy that coalition, racially divisive tactics were used. Phone calls were made to voters, not all voters, certain voters in certain sections of the city. And, you know, you can't take us for granted. If you want our vote, you got to respect that issue. And I think in the next go-round, whoever the candidates are, hopefully the Democratic side will have learned that if you play that game, you're going to lose the election.
I think it's part of a continuum. I think that if you go back a while, I think beginning in 1988, when Jesse Jackson, by capturing New York in his presidential primary drive in the Democratic Party, more or less put together that coalition of black and Latinos, which Dinkins won on. 4 years later, though, I think that Giuliani was able to break that coalition by operating Ninfa Segarra, Herman Badillo, and others to break to get enough of the Latino vote over to the Republican Party to break what had been the coalition that got Dinkins elected, which allowed Giuliani to win. And I think if you look at the numbers, much is being made about the disaffection of the Latino vote. And anyone who walked the streets of the Bronx and upper Manhattan, as I and several others did, I mean, it's pretty clear that Green was gone insofar as the Democrat Latino and African American Democrats being enthusiastic about his winning. But having said that, when you look at the numbers, what you find is that when Ruth Messengers 4 years ago ran against Giuliani, 43% of the Latinos voted for Giuliani. So it is not this massive disaffection of the Latino votes on the Republican Party. Giuliani had 43% of them 4 years ago, and so there's about 47, only 3 points up. I think the problem is that a lot of them did not come out on the Latino side. And if you look at the African-American side in the final, 71% of the African-American voted for a state with Mark Green.
Well, that's true. I think the question, I think Les points out correctly, is that the Latino voters were disaffected and voted with their feet.
Right.
And if you in a close race like this, every vote counts. And, you know, Mr. Green ran the campaign. One said that he was already, you know, measuring the drapes for Gracie Mansion before he had won the election. But turn to Mr. Bloomberg. Now, the question going forward is, well, what kind of a mayor is he going to be? And, yeah, he's a rich multimedia mogul. But I think, at least at this juncture, and since he is the mayor, you know, I'm looking for signals. The fact that he sat down with Freddie Ferrer the day after the election says a lot to me. And if he has any, you know, any ability and any sense at all, he'll realize that this city faces the worst economic crisis it has faced since, as you said, the 70s, maybe even since the Depression, because of the devastation that attack on the World Trade Center has wrought in New York City. And there's going to be a lot of pain in New York City over the next 4 years.
I want to bring in our guest in the studio right now, Rachel Leon, who is executive director of Common Cause in New York. Bloomberg LP, it's established in 1981, provides news and information to clients, including financial services firms and media outlets, also has radio, television, and publishing operations. Michael Bloomberg is the largest shareholder, almost three quarters, has 7,800 employees in 67 countries. Key product, the Bloomberg, a computer terminal providing clients with real-time financial and general news and market data. It's got 162,000 terminals worldwide. Annual sales from terminals, $2.4 billion. Total sales, $2.5 billion. And Michael Bloomberg spent, more than $55 million of his own money, and used that in a saying, trying to cast it in a positive way, saying it means I'm beholden to no one. What do you think about that, Rachel Leon?
Well, I certainly think this race is the newest vivid illustration of the man with the deepest pockets getting the most speech. I mean, he spent estimated more than $40 million of those dollars on TV ads and other media advertising. So I think what we've seen is 6,500 ads for Bloomberg versus 2,500 ads for Mark Green. So certainly money talked loud and clear in this election. Now, there were other voices, which we've been talking about, and a lot of other things, like September 11th and the Giuliani endorsement. But, I mean, there's no doubt that he was able to buy so much time and that we're going to have to reclaim our airwaves if we want to keep democracy flourishing. So, I mean, it's frustrating because we live in a city with the best working public financing program in the country. And it's a testament to that that Mark Green, I think, was even competitive against Bloomberg because of that public financing system. But if you have these billionaires and it's a voluntary system, they can just walk all over it.
I think when Mark Green gave his concession speech early on Wednesday morning, he said that an aide had turned to him and said, you're being outspent by $45 million. No one has ever won with that kind of discrepancy. And he said, well, maybe we didn't beat the odds here. What about that? I mean, with all of the politics on the ground that we've heard Les Payne and Randy McLaughlin describing, do you think it just came down to the brute force of money, Bloomberg not being around very much, but just absolute avalanche of torrent of ads constantly?
Well, I don't think that Bloomberg won because of money, but I don't think he would have been a serious candidate without it. And then if you couple that with everything else that was happening and the fact that he was able to buy time during the World Series, I mean, we just can't underestimate the power of getting these commercials over and over and over again. So I think it's several factors, but certainly money influenced this race.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. Money had an influence.
Randy Scott McLaughlin.
But remember, the vote was extremely close. You know, I'm looking at the numbers today. It was 47% to 50%, a 3% differential. If Mark Green had gotten 4% more of the voters, there would have been a world of difference. So even with all his money, he didn't get a landslide. Now, where did Mark Green's vote not turn out? Well, the unions didn't support him the way they supported him nominally, but 1199 has one of the strongest get-out-the-vote machines in the city of New York, and they weren't there for him. Why? Because he had alienated Mr. Rivera and the way he handled the Ferrer matter. Mr. Ramirez in the Bronx also has a strong machine, probably one of the last machine politicians left in New York City, and he didn't turn out to vote for him. So, you know, you can spend money, but if you don't get your voters out, and he didn't, and Bloomberg doesn't have a street campaign. He doesn't have shock troops that can bring out voters and drive them to the polls. So he depended on the buck. And when you're running against money, you have to meet that with people. And Green just alienated the people who could deliver the voters to the polls.
Rachel,
that you bring up important points, and I think that that's a lot of what happened in this election. But we also can't underestimate the way that campaigns have changed. And they've gone from grassroots door-to-door campaigns to campaigns on television. And so if you look at the United States, which is one of the only countries in the world that doesn't offer free airtime to candidates, we can't say it's not a factor. It's not the deciding factor, but it's a serious factor.
When you talked about public airwaves, explain what you mean and what you want to see. What is Common Cause advocating?
Well, it's supposed to be, allegedly, that the public owns the airwaves. And yet, you know, we take broadcasters on their word that they're going to do public service. And so then we allow them to make billions of dollars off this. In the 2000 elections alone, you know, candidates paid them more than $1 billion to run these ads. So this is a huge profit industry. And now more than ever, we have to look at this system and say, not only, you know, does it offer ads instead of real discourse on the candidates during an election, but it's overshadowing one of the finest public financing systems in the country. I mean, we had an election of contrasts this week. We had small grassroots candidates that raised, you know, dozens of small contributions that were able to make campaigns because of the public financing program. And then you have Bloomberg on the other side who didn't participate in the program and tried to make a mockery of it. So we need to deal with free airtime. We need to get back to the broadcasters, you know, giving something back to the public for all the profit that they make.
Les Payne.
I don't disagree with that. I think it is a separate issue, though. I mean, I think we can obviously discuss them at the same time because they're part of the same process. I happen to think, I mean, if you look at what Perot did some years ago, going directly to the people with his little video cassettes. So I think there is a way that you avoid scrutiny, as Bloomberg did, going directly to the people. And campaign finance reform certainly is an issue that whose time is past and hopefully will get dealt with. But going back to the other side of the equation, I think that all of that said, and I don't disagree with anything I've heard on the Common Cause side, Bloomberg coming from nowhere. I mean, a year ago, we didn't know who he was. I mean, granted, we don't know enough about him, but we didn't know who he was other than his name on his media outlets. But I think getting back to the issue of Mark Green, I think that despite his coming from obscurity, Bloomberg, to being almost a household word on ads, it was still Mark Green's campaign, I think, toward the end of the day to lose, and I think he seemed to have worked pretty mightily to lose it. And I think that what he emphasized is one of those things that people don't like to talk about. In fact, this has kind of been put off the burner, is that the reality is that 54% of the city is Latino and African American. And these campaigns and a run with that thing in mind, I think that someone like Sharpton plays an enormous role here, and we could talk about it. I mean, often he plays a double game and sometimes even a triple game. But without getting into the Sharpton factor, I think that
what's the triple game?
Well, the triple game is he talks to everybody. He talks to all sides all the time, and God only knows what deal he has going with all sides all the time. I think that we need to be a bit, I mean, I think the critical question or a critical question about, for instance, if you look at what the Latinos voters did, there's no question but Roberto Ramirez and as was just described early, a lot of the Latino leaders, I mean, if you went to the Bronx County office, I mean, last week it was closed, Sunday it was closed. Workers were told to vote and to take the day off on election day. These are the get out the vote people, the phone banks. So there's no question but that the Bronx machine closed down for its candidate in a city that is 5-1 Democratic. So Green, because they had turned against Green. But the question, it seemed to me, is was their disaffection with Green a strategy worked out in the cold logic of realpolitik, or was it just kind of an emotional reaction to a perceived slight by Green on the part of Ferrer? And the more you look at it, unfortunately, I think it is that this thing was personal and narrow and not tactical and sustainable and politically logical. And I think that perhaps is a mistake.
I think you're
right. Me.
I think that the voters weren't voting, the Hispanic voters who gave 47% of their vote to Bloomberg didn't, and 49% to Green. I mean, it's a pretty close number. They didn't look at Mr. Bloomberg as their savior or as someone who's going to trumpet their cause. I think it was an anti-Green vote, and it was an emotional vote, in my opinion, against the tactics of Mr. Green.
And therefore, kind of silly, isn't it?
Well, people vote for all sorts of reasons, Les. And, you know, people, they're emotional voters. I think some voters voted because they were afraid that Mr. Green couldn't lead the city out of the economic crisis that it's in and rather have a businessman do that. People vote for all sorts of reasons. People voted for John F. Kennedy because he looked good.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Les Payne, Deputy Managing Editor of Newsday, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. Rachel Leon, Executive Director of Common Cause New York. Web contact is commoncause.org. And Randy Scott McLaughlin, Professor of Law at Pace University and voting rights expert. When we come back, we're going to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and we'll speak with Azmi Bashara, a member of the Israeli Knesset. He is an Arab member of the Knesset. He has been stripped of immunity, the first time for issues of speech. We'll find out why. Stay with us.
Did you see them praying? Watch the army marching in. As they clubbed old women, did you see the general grin? Watch the stones fly and the snipers taking aim. on Shatila's birthday. It's a calculated game, and they're gunning down the children of Jerusalem. Did you hear him screaming? Watch the horror in his face as he hid for cover in a tiny unprotected space. Did you see his father pleading? There is a child here, trying to protect his son, who yelled in horror and in fear that they're gunning down the children of Jerusalem.
David Rovix live in our Firehouse studio will be with us through this hour and the next of our two-hour War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the Israeli Knesset has voted to revoke the parliamentary immunity of Palestinian MK, that's member of Knesset Azmi Bashara. Bashara is the only parliamentary representative of the National Democratic Assembly, the first Palestinian party in Israel to call for the transformation of Israel into a state for all its citizens. The action comes after Israel's attorney general filed two separate draft indictments against Bashara and will allow Bashara to stand trial. The first indictment charges him with incitement to violence and support for a terrorist organization, that's Hezbollah, as defined by Israel's Prevention of Terror Ordinance. It's for two speeches Bashara gave, one at a rally in an Arab town inside Israel, the other at a memorial ceremony for Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. In both speeches, Bashara addressed the internationally recognized right for an occupied people to resist occupation. The second indictment charges Bashara with violating Israel's emergency regulations by, quote, abetting illegal exit from the country. Bashara organized humanitarian visits to Syria for elderly Palestinian citizens of Israel who've been forcibly separated from their families for over 50 years. Well, this is the first time that the Israeli Knesset has removed a member of parliament's immunity for speech rather than on criminal charges. Azmi Bashara is a well-known Palestinian intellectual and politician, head of the Arab Students Union throughout Israeli universities in the 1970s. He taught philosophy and political science at Birzeit University in Ramallah. In 1999, Azmi Bashara became the first Palestinian to run for Prime Minister of Israel. In this year's election, which pitted Ariel Sharon against former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, he called for a boycott of the elections, and he joins us now from Jerusalem. Azmi Bashara, can you tell us your response to the indictments?
Well, I think the indictment is the beginning, actually, of a longer process which aims at delegitimizing Arab participation in Israeli politics. They want, of course, to introduce stating political ideas as if it is a crime. It's the first time that the immunity of a Knesset member is lifted or revoked because of political statements that he made. So it also reflects, actually, a nationalist, radical, and even chauvinist atmosphere in the parliament and in the Israeli streets. And this atmosphere, this mood, is used by the Israeli establishment to redraw the limits of Israeli democracy so that Arabs will be excluded. Of course, they begin with Azmi Bashara, but it seems that the precedent is dangerous because it may lead to more exclusion of more Arab Knesset members and probably the Arabs in Israel. So it is heading in the direction of an apartheid system, actually.
Can you summarize the indictments against you?
Well, the first indictment has to do with political statements that I did, giving legitimacy or recognizing or acknowledging the right of people under occupation to resist occupation in South Lebanon at the time of Israeli occupation and the West Bank and Gaza as well. Now, this sympathy to resistance of occupation and to the right of people to fight for their self-determination against the violence of occupation, against the daily violence of occupation, was considered by the Israeli establishment here as identification or expressing sympathy to terrorism, which is false, which is not true at all. And the second charge has to do with enabling Arab citizens from this country, elderly people usually, to visit the refugee camps in Syria in order to meet brothers and sisters, and literally brothers and sisters, from the same parents who they did not meet for 53 years, since 1948. We're speaking about old people whose first and last chance to meet these brothers and sisters and relatives before they die was granted by this effort that I made by convincing the Syrian government to list these people in. Now, the Israelis consider this a humanist effort that is usually organized in the world by organizations like the Red Cross. They consider it an organized trips to an enemy country, according to the emergency rules. The emergency rules were introduced here by the British colonialism and were meant to prevent offenses against the security of the country and to prevent espionage or something like that. But these trips were organized publicly. The people legally moved from Israel to Jordan and from Jordan to Syria. The media covered that. It was even very exciting in the media for many people to see, very moving, very touching for people to see how old people meet each other after 53 years. And all this turned into a charge in an Israeli court against the political, against a Knesset member who anyway has immunity.
Is it true that an Israeli Arab reporter went with you to Syria and showed it on television?
No, an Arab reporter from the Israeli TV, from the official Israeli TV, accompanied them to the refugee camps, and he made a film about it for the Israeli news, for the Israeli First Channel. So everything was so public and so known, etc. Suddenly it becomes a charge. Of course, according to the, not the spirit of the law, but according to the text, yes, these trips are illegal. But since when? I mean, these laws are meant to prevent brothers from meeting brothers or sisters from meeting sisters. This was not the spirit of law. This was not meant to prevent people like these to meet.
And on the issue of resistance, do you support armed struggle?
Well, I cannot support or not support armed struggle. I cannot even call for armed struggle. I used the parliamentary work in order to be in the parliament and to use political means. But people in Nablus or in Hebron under Israeli occupation, they do not have democratic tools to use. Occupation is violence, and resisting occupation is resisting violence. Now, international conventions recognize this right, and it even the Geneva Convention speaks about by all means. I do not say by all means. I say the right to people to resist occupation. Of course, I draw certain limits. And I draw certain limits not because I want each day to condemn the actions of the Palestinians in order to find admiration by the Israelis. In general, my position is that killing innocent civilians is immoral, and also for political purposes is wrong. It doesn't bring anything for any just cause. It is immoral, it is unjustifiable, but it's also irrational too. These are the limits that I draw. But in general, people under occupation, resist occupation, they did that in France. That's where the word resistance comes from, actually. We didn't have it before that. And it was used in Algeria against the French. Of course, the French killed the Algerian resistance terrorism, but they called their own resistance against the German occupation. And it was used in every national liberation movement. Resistance is something recognized, especially in the second half of the 20th century. It became actually international consent. Terrorism is a different story. It has different roots. It has different reasons. It goes in different directions. There's still another differentiation to make concerning international terrorism. This is another third category. We are speaking about the right of people to resist occupation. And this is a right, and we are not going to move from this principal position just in order to be in the Knesset. We will lose our own political identity and just be there in the Knesset as a part of the Israeli Zionist consent.
We're also joined on the telephone from Jerusalem by Dr. Amnon Raz Krakoskin. Can you tell us your response to this unprecedented revocation of parliamentary immunity on the basis of speech?
Well, I think that indeed it tells more about the state of Israel and Israeli society in the present than on Azmi Bshara and his statements, because his statements indeed are moderate and very, very important and interesting, as usual, because Azmi, for a long time, is one of the most significant intellectuals in Israel and challenged many aspects of the Israeli consciousness. And in that sense, I think that the problem of the problem is not only to delegitimize the very political participations of Arab citizens in politics in Israel, but also the political debate itself. Because rather than a political debate on these arguments, which are so important, they condemn them through a campaign of incitement against Azmi, against his party, and against others. And the problem is that, unfortunately, most of the Israeli society participate in this attempt to delegitimation and demonization.
Dr. Amnon Raz Krakoskin, as a Israeli Jew, what do you think of Azmi Bashara's laying out of a democratic state that is not determined by your religion, in this case being Jewish?
Yeah. As an Israeli Jew, I indeed hope for a common state, an equal democratic state of all its citizens, rather than continuing with the definition of a Jewish state that excludes its Arab citizens. And I think that what happened with Azmi Bshara is that he revealed the contradictions of the attempt to define Israel as a Jewish state and directs towards a different definition. And therefore, I think that Azmi Bshara's ideas, Azmi Bshara's statements, are a very important challenge for any Jew in Israel. And I hope that more Jews will agree to discuss it, and to discuss it in the political terms, rather than exclude it into the court, because this is not the place. You see, as an Israeli Jew, it's unbelievable to think of people of victims and refugees who condemned and prevent the visits of its citizens to visit their refugee relatives in Lebanon and in this case in Syria. It's simply unbelievable. And the question is indeed how we should define differently Jewish collectivity in Palestine. And that's why I think Azmi Bshara's challenge is so important. And we have to use this opportunity, unfortunately, to reveal the nature of Israeli democracy.
Dr. Amnon Raz Krakoskin, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of Jewish History at Ben-Gurion University, and Dr. Azmi Bshara, member of the Israeli Knesset, who's just been stripped of his parliamentary immunity for speech. That does it for this program. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Salone is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland's at WBIX.org, where we broadcast live. Also at webactive.com and our website, democracynow.org. Tonight, I'll be at SUNY Stony Brook to hear a speech of Lori Garrett on bioterrorism at the Stoller Recital Hall. That's at Stony Brook, Long Island. Tomorrow, Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. Democracy Now in Exile, broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Did you see the roadblocks letting nobody go past? Watch the blood flow as time is running fast. See someone's brother taking his last breath.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. As Congress debates legislation on airport security, workers and community groups say real security means higher wages and more rights for airport employees. In an unforgiving national climate, radical-turned community activist Sarah Jane Olson pleads guilty to charges she planted a bomb decades ago but claims she's not guilty of the charges. We'll speak with her. And Beyond the Burqa, a look at a film about life for Afghan women living under the veil of Islamic fundamentalism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Afghan opposition forces say today they're advancing steadily toward the key northern city of Mazar-e Sharif with the help of round-the-clock U.S. bombing. Both sides said fighting was intense south of Mazar, which the Taliban seized from the opposition Northern Alliance in 1998. Taliban Bakhtar News Agency said U.S. jets bombed in eastern Kunar province yesterday, killing three civilians, injuring six, flattening an empty school. The White House, meanwhile, put new emphasis on the humanitarian aid it's providing Afghanistan. President Bush said after a meeting with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, quote, "We talked a lot about making sure that our great compassion for the innocents in Afghanistan is fulfilled," adding, "We must feed the people." Humanitarian groups around the world have condemned the bombing, at least pleading with the U.S. and Britain to stop now so that aid can be rushed to the estimated 7 million Afghans at risk of starvation in the coming months. White House senior advisor Karl Rove will meet with top-level Hollywood executives on Sunday to hammer out an entertainment industry agenda for aiding the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. At the instigation of the White House, invitations were sent to the president of the Motion Picture Association of America, Jack Valenti, Viacom Entertainment CEO, Jonathan Dolgan, Paramount Pictures Chair, Sherry Lansing, and Rupert Murdoch. The invite subsequently went out to the owners and CEOs of the various studios and networks, most of whom quickly agreed to attend. A key figure in arranging the session was Gerald Parsky, who ran the Bush campaign in California. The press will be barred from the Sunday summit, which will take place at a Beverly Hills hotel. One executive who planned to attend the meeting likened the effort to those that followed Pearl Harbor, but insisted Hollywood can contribute in positive ways without becoming a propaganda organ. In related news, the House of Representatives yesterday, by a near unanimous vote, approved a measure to establish a radio-free Afghanistan to broadcast news and explain U.S. war aims to Afghans in their local languages. Supporters said the broadcasts, which cannot be aired in the United States since they constitute state propaganda, were needed to get the truth to the Afghan people. Some Congress members have been critical of the Voice of America, which purports to offer straightforward news, for not advocating the U.S. position strongly enough. Said Pennsylvania Democrat Congressmember Joseph Huffel, quote, "We must blanket the people of Afghanistan with the voice of freedom, truth, and democracy, as we blanket the Taliban with bombs." Israeli lawmakers voted to lift the parliamentary immunity of Azmi Bashara, an Israeli Arab legislator, so he can be prosecuted for remarks urging resistance to Israel and for arranging visits by Israeli Arabs to Syria, with which Israel is technically at war. It was the first time a lawmaker has been stripped of his immunity for political statements. At a memorial gathering in Damascus last June after the death of President Hafez al-Assad, Bashara called for broadening, quote, the path of resistance to Israel. He denies he incited violence and says he supports the right of Palestinians to struggle against Israeli occupation. After weeks of frequent, often tumultuous briefings by Taliban officials, Pakistan's government this week formally asked Taliban diplomats to stop holding news conferences at the Afghan embassy to denounce U.S. military attacks. The request reportedly followed complaints from U.S. officials about the briefings on the embassy lawn, at which Taliban envoys describe U.S. bombs hitting hospitals and schools and defending Osama bin Laden and claiming the United
States is using chemical and biological weapons to flush him out of his Afghan hideout. In addition, Pakistani newspapers reported the government has clamped down on domestic broadcasts by Al Jazeera, the Qatar-based satellite television network that has regularly broadcast video of alleged bombing damage in Afghanistan and statements by bin Laden.
When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with Joe Hill at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike, there was no one flipping burgers. The grills were cold, onion rings were in their bags, fries were growing mold. There were no baristas at Starbucks asking how many shots would you like, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. There was no one pumping gasoline, no one driving from town to town, no one at the registers, all the highways were shut down. The cars were stuck in the garage, CEOs on bikes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. The fruit was falling off the trees, no one to load the trucks. Corn was rotting on the stalks, no farmhands to shuck. Workfare workers were hanging at home, spending the day with their tights, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike.
David Rovics, live in our Firehouse studio. Well, speaking of people going on strike and union matters, a federal judge yesterday blocked enforcement of an executive order signed by President Bush that would prevent federally funded contracts from including agreements between employers and unions setting wages, benefits, and hiring conditions. The Building and Construction Trades Department of the AFL-CIO had sued the Bush administration, claiming the executive order violated the rights of employers and unions protected by the National Labor Relations Act. You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Congressional negotiators met yesterday to try and reconcile competing bills on airport security, but adjourned without agreement after only an hour. The House and Senate have been unable to agree on the key issue of whether thousands of airport security workers should be put on government payrolls. The Senate last week unanimously passed a bill that would federalize airport security workers. Days later, the House passed a bill that would keep private contractors in charge of airport workers, but bring them under tighter federal regulation. The bitter congressional fight, however, has obscured real differences in the labor movement over how best to organize airport workers. Community groups involved with airport workers say the debate has also obscured the question of how wages and working conditions affect airport security. Ken Jacobs is on the line with us, director of the Bay Area Organizing Project. Can you lay it out for us?
Sure. The most important issue or issues around security at the airport for the workers have to do with wages and working conditions. At San Francisco International Airport, when we and unionization, when we started here over 2 years ago, we were dealing with a situation where baggage screeners were earning $6.25 an hour, and many of them were working multiple jobs. So you'd have a person like Rolando Pendon, 71 years old. He would get to work 9 p.m., work till 7 a.m. screening bags, have an hour off, work another 8-hour security shift, go home and get 2 hours of sleep at night. Under those conditions, it's impossible for anybody to do the work right. At the same time, people aren't given the level of breaks they need but there's between screening and other jobs, so that their eyes can stay focused and people can really focus on their work. By organizing it at the airport, wages at SFO are now up for screeners, was $10, and now it's up to $13 an hour. Turnover has dropped from over 100% a year to down to now 18%, which means before it was a situation where your average screener stayed on the job for, had been on the job for about 4 months because you could make more by going to work at McDonald's. Now you've got a situation where the wages are higher and people are staying, which means you have more experienced workers, which has had a direct impact on how many violations people are finding. The problems that are coming out in some of these bills are, one, at San Francisco International Airport, we recognize that security is not just about baggage screeners. It's about all workers with access to the tarmac, all workers who touch the bags, and the living wages that we want at the airport were for all of those workers. Two, the bill in San Francisco, the House bill, includes provisions saying workers cannot be citizens, which is quite serious. 71% of the screeners in San Francisco are Filipino. These are people who are generally highly skilled, even potentially overqualified based on the jobs they had at the Philippines. The problem has not been the work that they do. It's not the workers, it's the working conditions. And three, the Senate bill, which is, has the federalization, also contains serious restrictions on organizing. And one of the most important areas for ensuring security is that workers need to be able to complain, need to be able to bring up problems without fear of retaliation. To do that, they need a union environment. So say that neither of these bills directly and correctly address fully the questions of wages, the questions of this issue about citizenship, which is a problem, the breadth of who needs to be covered around security, nor the question of guaranteeing that people actually have a voice on the job.
The way the debate has been portrayed in the press is that the House, led by basically Dick Armey, sort of speaking on this issue, does not want the workers to become members of unions. That's what they sort of equate totally as being federalized. What do you think about that, and what do the unions see this as the division between the House bill and the Senate bill that was overwhelming? It was 100-0 right. For federalizing workers.
No, that's right. But also, what's been responded by folks in the Senate to Dick Armey is, don't worry, we put in provisions that are going to seriously restrict workers' voice on the job. So neither of these bills addresses what's needed in terms of workers having a voice on the job. And SEIU has successfully organized workers in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, where they have succeeded in significantly raising wages, changing working conditions, and giving people a voice on the job, which has had a dramatic impact, like we said, in turnover, which directly relates to performance. So SEIU's argument has been the federalization versus not is the wrong debate. The debate is guaranteeing workers a voice on the job.
Ken Jacobs with us, director of the Bay Area Organizing Project, recently completed a study on the impact of higher wages on airport security. We're also joined on the telephone by Tom Martin, who's a SkyCap at San Francisco International Airport for the past 17 years. What exactly do you do, Tom?
I've been a SkyCap. I work curbside and check bags and sort people out on the curb.
If you could speak as loud as you can and directly into the phone, I'm having a little trouble understanding you.
Okay.
Can you talk about what a living wage would mean for you? I mean, what do SkyCaps now make?
Well, we were included in the the Quality Standards Program, so we are now up to $10 an hour. Previously, we had made minimum wage plus whatever we made in tips, which is not guaranteed income, so... been quite an improvement.
How did the living wage movement affect efforts to organize at the airport?
Well, it was very beneficial in that it was kind of a 1-2 punch, if you will. By working with the Living Wage Coalition, we were able to get people involved in the process of trying to deal with management as far as having a voice and getting them to realize that they were able to express their concerns and problems to management, and that there were things that could be done that would improve working conditions and our situation at the airport. And because of that, they saw that they were able to have a voice, and that the best solution to our problems was to organize and have unions that would represent us as far as being able to express our concerns and problems and not have to worry about being retaliated by management.
Why is unionization, do you see becoming a member of a union, important for airport security?
Well, primarily because it helps in, guarantee working conditions and pay, and also very important that creates a voice for the workers on the job. Without a voice, people are intimidated by management and feel that they'll be fired if they bring up any kind of issues or problems with the job, and with the union, they don't have to fear that and feel more able to address the problems that there are there, which I think is very important, especially in terms of security, because we have to find some way to solve the problems.
What does it mean to be an airport worker and to be a union activist? Are they cracking down on you at the airport? Are people being fired?
Well, there has been some retaliation for our organizing efforts and also the Living Wage campaign, actually. It's pretty much the usual battle, I guess, as far as management not wanting to or insisting that they can't afford to increase people's pay and improve working conditions and things like that. That'll put them out of business and things. And what we found, of course, is that that is not true. That has not happened. And in fact, some of the companies that were resistant and fought the idea of increasing pay and improving working conditions are now trumpeting the idea, saying that they go along with this or are for this because it has improved their ability to attract better people and to retain people. So eliminates the cost to them of having to retrain people all the time and to give people new uniforms and all of the costs that are incurred by the whole process of employing new people. So they are now a lot of them.
Finally, Tom Martin, what is it like to be a SkyCap at the airport since September 11th? In what ways has your life changed?
Well, it was a pretty dramatic change initially. We were closed curbside for several weeks, and fortunately, common sense dictated that because we had the same security procedures as the folks that work inside at the counter, the agents, that it was really a perception problem more than anything else. So they allowed us to open up again, but business is slow, so it has impacted our incomes. But we are feel fortunate that we're back at work and we are working again. So we have some of the contractors have us doing other things besides doing our SkyCap jobs, checking people's tickets at the checkpoint before they go to the gates and things like that. So we've had to pick up some other security-related jobs, but we're back and forth between doing that and working out on the curb.
Ken Jacobs, director of the Bay Area Organizing Project, as we wrap up, what do you think are the greatest misunderstandings about the whole issue of airport workers now, security, and the legislation that is being passed now?
One, that airport security is not just a question of baggage screeners. There's a whole series and train of workers who touch the bags, who have access to the planes, who have access to the tarmac. If we are serious about airport security, we have to be serious about the wages of and working conditions of all those workers. Two, that this question of the citizenship of security workers is just a wrong question. We've got, like I said, 70% of the screeners in San Francisco are Filipino. These are dedicated immigrants. They're dedicated people who have the capacity to do a good job once the working conditions are there. And putting forward a bill that would toss out all of those people would be a disaster for security at the airport. And three, if we're serious about security, workers have got to have a voice on the job, and that means they've got to be able to unionize. And neither bill addresses that.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Ken Jacobs, director of the Bay Area Organizing Project. If people want to get a hold of the report, where can they go on the web or call?
The website with me. To get a hold of the report, it's on the website for the Institute for Industrial Relations at the University of California at Berkeley.
And we'll have that information at democracynow.org. And folks, you can listen to us at wbix.org, at webactive.com, and at our newly launched website, thanks to Jackie Suen. And that is democracynow.org with all phone numbers and website information. Tom Martin, also thanks for being with us. SkyCap at San Francisco International Airport for the last 17 years. When we come back from our break, we're going to look behind the burqa. We're going to look at a film that is out on women in Afghanistan. And we are also going to be speaking with Sarah Jane Olson. She recently pled guilty to involvement in a planned bombing, but then when she left the courtroom, as she said, she had felt she was forced into that situation because of the climate of our times and that, in fact, she's innocent. We'll have a conversation. Stay with us. Edwin Starr, War, here on Stop the War Now, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S.-led coalition against terrorism promises that a draft U.N. Security Council resolution would stress the responsibility of a transitional government in Afghanistan to eradicate human rights violations, as well as terrorism. The U.N. Special Envoy has said that any post-Taliban government would, quote, reflect the will of the Afghan people. But President Bush, Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain, and the UN Security Council have not demonstrated they'll insist on specific guarantees for the rights and representation of Afghan women. There's been no mention of women's participation in decisions on future governance in Afghanistan. Last March, well before September 11th, brought Afghanistan to the world's attention, Ayara Lee traveled to Afghanistan to make a short film about women's lives. She stayed with and interviewed members of the Afghan group HACA, Humanitarian Assistance to the Women and Children of Afghanistan. And she joins us in our Firehouse studio now. Welcome.
Shalom.
Is that how you pronounce the name of the group?
HACA, Humanitarian HACA. Aid for Women and Children in Afghanistan.
And how did you find this group?
It's, you know, chain reaction of meeting here and there. Sundance Institute, they had done a documentary series, and they had invited people from Bosnia, countries in conflict, and they did a documentary a session for the festival. And Nicole Guilleme had put me in contact with some of the people there, and then I visited and we did a tour. We went through Peshawar and then Khyber Pass, Torkan. Orzala from HACA, she is just a woman who moved from Afghanistan to Peshawar to Pakistan, where we have over 2 million refugees. And she opened this school for street kids. And unlike the madrasas where kids are indoctrinated, fundamentalism, she tries to have a school where she teaches history, science, language, and the normal curriculum, non-religious curriculum. And, you know, this is not an institution. This is just a woman's effort to do something for her country. Obviously, she had lost her brothers and parents through the war, and that's what she was telling me. The problem is if you don't allow women to work, but then all the women are widowed because they lost their husbands in the war, what are they supposed to do to feed their children? So she's been very involved in the women's movement, but it's a non-political movement. This, in contrast to RAWA, who is a very political movement.
Well, Iyarli, let's take a look at the film that you did. I should say that we are a collaboration of public community access TV stations and public radio. And so the people who are listening on radio and the internet right now will hear the voices. People on the Dish Network, Free Speech TV's Channel 9415, and public access TV stations around the country will watch this. And it actually, your film Beyond the Burqa begins with Orzala Ashrali, the founder of the organization HACA, Humanitarian Assistance to the Women and Children of Afghanistan. Let's take a listen.
International community in general, I mean the people of the world in general, they're always talking about human rights, women's rights, and they always condemn the violation of human rights. But I think Afghanistan is a country today that the word of human rights doesn't exist.
I believe that this is the time that the world should come forward and help the Afghans, because the Afghan war is not a civil war. It has got a lot of regional and international involvement. The thing is, we've got Central Asia in the north, we've got China, we've got Pakistan and Iran. Now, Afghanistan is the center of international Islamic terrorism, drugs production, and all these fanatic kind of ideologies. A lot of people fled Afghanistan not because of hunger or because of cold. We have had all these problems for 20 years. But a lot of people are escaping because they're threatened to be killed by the Taliban. And all these people, they're willing their children to die from cold and hunger in the refugee camps in Pakistan, but they don't want to stay under the Taliban regime.
Today we are in our worst moment of the history of our country. They started to destroy even the statues, even the heritage of our country, which is value not only for Afghanistan but for the world.
Before the Islamic Revolution, women got membership in a parliament. We have women engineers, doctors. But then when the extremist Taliban came over, they forced the women completely to stay away from any kind of social engagement, like working outside or studying in colleges. They even closed down the primary schools for the women. It's a system to make slaves. And I think it's a very clear, you know, gender apartheid.
Wearing burqa is a part of our culture. But before the arrival of Taliban, it was on your own choice. But now the difference is that you have to. You might be sick. You, as she says, I have to wear glasses. I can't put my glasses on the burqa or under the burqa. Now all the women are prohibited from working. It's a very big problem because most of the families in Afghanistan have lost their male members in the fightings. The women cannot go to the market. You cannot go to a doctor, especially to a male doctor. And a woman's voice should not be heard by men. It's nonsense. Everything, nothing is left for the new generation. And the new generation is growing to be a wild one.
I have a life to serve my country.
To serve.
How are you going to serve your country?
No, jengi, fighting.
Oh God. He's going to be pilot with fighting jets.
Against my enemies.
That's why you're learning English?
Yes.
He is trying to guide the American people to become Muslims.
Are you a Taliban?
Yes, I'm a Taliban.
Did you hear that they destroy all the Buddha statues?
وي دادي و اوريدي دي چدا د بوت با ميانو دا زين خراب كړي دي
اه يس اتس گود
ولي
گود يس
اخو زمونګ استاسو فرهنګ او اخو زمونګ استاسو ملک يوا
دا اسلامي شريعت
He says that, well, this is Islamic Sharia and this is the saying of our holy prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that the statues everywhere should be destroyed.
دما په اسلامي کتابونه کې انګلیش ورته دما په اسلامي کتابونه کې
He says that I studied this from the Islamic books. I have to say that the school where he is studying is the school by some fundamentalists. That's why he learned all these things. There are two kinds of education in Afghanistan at the present. One kind is schools that are running by some supporters of fundamentalists, restricted for women. But the other kind of schools is, for example, we have also a primary school for children in which we mainly try to help learn mathematics, science, and English as a language. The teachers of our school are never allowed to talk about politics in the classes, to talk about guns. We just encourage them to love peace, to not fight with each other, to not think that the best toy for the children is gun. HACA is the acronym for humanitarian assistance for the women and children of Afghanistan. And it has been established in January 1999. This is a non-profit-making, non-governmental and non-political organization which is mainly work in five different fields such as education, healthcare, income generation, sanitation and counseling. Try to keep your children clean. Try to wash their hands before lunch and after going to toilet. And try to teach your children to wash their face and their hands all the time. Most of the diseases that you people have is mainly because you don't care about your cleanliness. If you wash your hands, you can not be suffering by different diseases like diarrhea.
This is stent for malnutrition, for malnourished child. We are providing the supplementary food for the malnutrition as well. And we are giving the health education for the mother of malnourished child. This is stent of minor surgery and we are providing facility for dressing as well.
What happened to this child?
He burned 1 week ago. We have the medicine for the main disease, but the death rate is one per day. One per day, yeah.
It is very difficult to help these children to get education because most of them are working daily. Half time they are working, and another half they are coming to the school. Some of them are working in carpet weaving. Some of them are working in the automobile workshop. Some of them are working as servant in some landlords' houses. And some of them are looking the garbages to collect some plastics, as you say. You can find hundreds of doctors, engineers, teachers who had a normal life in Afghanistan, but now they were forced to leave their country and they were forced to live in Pakistan. And since they are a large number of refugees come in one time, it's very difficult for them to find a job or to find a good place to stay. Well, now the profession of the family is making bird cages, making some kind of typical Afghan drums, and with this money they make their living. The lady is saying that when the Russian went out, we felt that maybe there is security and there is peace in Afghanistan. And when we went back, we found that they are worse than Russians. Now there is no peace, there is fighting. The Taliban are killing their own countrymen, and the life of Afghans are not safe over there. Always trying to tell them that we understand that you are poor people and there is no need to have this hospitality with us. We understand everything. But even besides of insisting, they made the tea and they bought this typical Afghan tea with biscuits.
There have been a lot of educated people in Afghanistan, a lot of people who can be trusted, a lot of people who are working and fighting for democracy, for freedom of people, for freedom of women. So right now, I think it's very good for the international community to come forward and help the Afghans.
We urge our friends living in the Western countries to convey the message of the people who are apparently alive, but their spirit is dead.
Beyond the Burqa, Ayara Lee, filmmaker, a documentary that was done about the organization HACA, which is Humanitarian Assistance to the Women and Children of Afghanistan. The main site of the film was where again, Ayara Lee?
Kaiperinya.com.
Then the main site of yes.
We shot at the Jalazai refugee camp where the plastic tents are.
And that is where?
In Peshawar,
Pakistan.
Yeah, border city with Afghanistan.
And have you been in touch with women and specifically Orzala Ashrali since the bombing began in Afghanistan?
Yeah, since March we've been doing benefits throughout the country. We did in San Francisco, New York, L.A. We're doing one in L.A. and possibly the film festival in January, the Sundance. And basically, we work with a lot of women's organizations and grassroots organizations, fundraising for them. So periodically, we send funds.
And have you been in touch with?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what are they saying are the effects of the bombing?
Obviously, this is not a legal war, and this is not what we call smart bombs. This is what we call dumb bombs. There is the women and the population of Afghanistan, they are as victims of the Taliban as everybody else. So there is absolutely no point of randomly bombing Afghanistan. There is a lot of anger because obviously the Taliban are bad news, but not enough to justify what we are doing now. And there is all this propaganda now, and I am always concerned about showing my film because I don't want the film to be used to justify the bombing. For so long, nobody cared about the women's rights, and all of a sudden, CNN is showing films bringing up the rape women and all that, but not because they care about the women, because they're trying to justify what we are doing in their country.
And do you have any sense that women are being included in any discussion of a post-Taliban Afghanistan, or if there will be a post-Taliban Afghanistan, if the Taliban will remain in power?
Yeah, and that's what it is. I mean, we are not bringing the real issues, and we create our monsters. We created the Taliban. Now we're going to create another monster to go after the first monster. So now we go with the Northern Alliance, and it's just this vicious circle, you know. But the real issues are not addressed, you know, human rights violations and, you know, as Noam Chomsky says, what we are doing is silent genocide by allowing this to happen.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in. I know that this Sunday you will be having a discussion and a showing of the film at Galapagos Art and Performance Space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And for people who want to get more information on the film, you can go to ocularis.net. That's ocularis.net. You can also just go to our website, and we'll have the information there, democracynow.org. Ira Lee, thanks for sharing the film with us. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by Sarah Jane Olson talking about her case. She's just pleaded guilty in a California court, then walked outside and said she was innocent. Stay with us.
If I could sing a song for every bomb that flies, I'd sing each and all the days. If there were to be a verse for every dying child's cries, for every helpless father's gaze. If I could write a love letter for each corpse as it's carried, I'd never still my pen. If I had to stop a moment for each one as it's buried, I'd never move again. But the stocks are going up somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song for Basra.
David Rovics, live in the Firehouse studio, and you can see more about him at davidrovics.com. That's davidrovics.com. David has just returned, actually, from Hartford, Connecticut, where he performed a benefit last night for people who were involved in an anti-war protest and were arrested. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An angry Los Angeles judge scolded Sarah Jane Olson yesterday for publicly flip-flopping on her guilty plea to attempted murder charges last week and made her enter the plea again, repeating in court that she was in fact guilty. The case of Sarah Jane Olson has drawn a lot of attention recently. Papers describe her case scream fugitive revolutionary and terrorist radical. Olson pled guilty to charges that she plotted 26 years ago to bomb two police cars 2 days ago in a Los Angeles hearing on her case. Sarah Jane Olson reiterated her guilty plea, but stated unequivocally that she neither possessed the bombs, constructed the bombs, nor placed the bombs under police cars, but she acknowledged guilt under the definition of aiding and abetting. At the unusual hearing, the Los Angeles judge scolded Olson for her behavior. We're on the phone right now with Sarah Jane Olson and her attorney. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. Well, rather than me describe it, since I'm describing it from various reports, Sarah Jane Olson, why don't you tell us why you pled guilty, what you pled guilty to, and what you feel you are innocent of?
Oh, well, I pled guilty because I had never intended to plead guilty, and I think that Sean will back me up on this with no problem. Even after the events with the Twin Towers and the Pentagon on September 11th, but I immediately realized after I watched in a horrified manner the Twin Towers collapsed, I thought, oh, this is probably going to affect the public tremendously, and obviously the jurors in my case, and immediately started getting calls from friends and relatives and emails, numerous emails from members of my defense team saying that I should reassess my situation in light of September 11th. And it took me quite a while to come to terms with that, and finally I did begin listening to them. As they said, this is going to be very, very difficult. And then once the judge turned down our request for a continuance, saying that, you know, this had all been our fault strategically as a defense team, and constantly ignoring the fact that the DA had, over a period of time, at the last minute before we were going to trial, several times dumped enormous amounts of evidence on us, and then just basically said, good luck, try to wade your way through that and decide what we're going to use against you, that perhaps I had to reassess my situation. And so Sean spearheaded negotiations prior to my making the plea that just wound us down, backed us up against the wall more and more, and the DA said, well, what we're giving up is the conspiracy charge, which opens you up to a life sentence, so we expect you to basically give up everything else. And then after we signed the agreement in front of the judge, they reneged on that, too.
Let me give a little background for listeners. Prosecutors say that in 1975 that Sarah Olson, who we're speaking to right now, known then as Kathleen Scalia, was
Scalia. Nobody pronounces my name.
How do you pronounce it?
Scalia.
Was part of the Symbionese Liberation Army, a militant political group which committed a series of bank robberies and kidnappings and was accused of several murders. Six members of the group were killed by the police in 1974, after which SLA members allegedly tried to plant bombs on two police cars. At that time, you went underground, or shortly afterwards, took a new name, became a community activist in Minneapolis, and then were arrested 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you denying involvement in the bomb plot?
You know, this is Sean Chapman, her lawyer, and I'm sorry, I can't allow her to answer that question because, as you know, we have a sentencing coming up, and we also may have to deal with the parole board at some point in the future, so it would be wise for her to remain silent on that question.
What kind of sentence do you expect the judge to hand down?
Well, the judge will not hand down the sentence. He will simply tell her she must serve the term prescribed by law. The parole board will then set her release date, and we are certain that her release date will be set at 5 1/4 years, of which she will serve half.
So it would be about a little more than 2.5 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Could you, Sarah Jane Olson, talk about what you were doing at that time? Talk about the Symbionese Liberation Army. I guess in the past, the description of the case against you that I heard was that it was basically lifting line, chapter, and verse from Patty Hearst's autobiography. Or the book about Patty Hearst, and she was also in the SLA at the time that you were.
Well, you know, Sarah is the Sean Chamonix, and she
was
never a member of the SLA. We've always asserted that. She's always maintained that. And really, all that she did was give a passionate speech after her good friend, who had been a member of the SLA, was killed in that shootout on 54th Street. And she was contacted later by some members of the SLA to assist them. She gave them small amounts of money, but was never a member of the group, never participated in any violence whatsoever, and that's a very important distinction to make clear.
How is it that the prosecutors or the newspapers at that time portrayed it so differently? Can I ask that, Sarah Jane Olson? What do you think was their agenda?
Well, I suppose it was a big, juicy story. I mean, it's the same old story everywhere. You look at how things are portrayed today regarding the war or any aspect of it. You know, it's it's just whatever sells papers, and so the description of me today by most media is I remain as defiant as ever, you know, which gives me a laugh. I mean, it's just a matter of under a lot of pressure trying to retain a shred of one's dignity, and if that constitutes defiance, well, then so be it. However, it simply sounds better if I sound like a defiant bitch, you know, and so that's how they describe me. One thing that I do find very interesting is people have asked me over and over again, and this was suggested from the time that I was arrested, that perhaps my arrest, to some extent, has something to do with the LAPD trying to come up with a reason for why they were under so much fire at that time from the Rampart scandal. Rampart is one of the divisions here in Los Angeles, and there's a station house, and many of the officers in that operating Rampart were accused of setting up individuals, planting evidence, beating them, and perhaps this is a way to deflect some of the attention from that to show how dangerous the police lives are. And yet 2 days after the judge lets my plea stand, the LA Times is trumpeting the headlines, DA says no new charges expected in Rampart probe. And, of course, all the defense attorneys are saying, but there are so many officers that are indictable, and they're saying, no, we should wrap this up now by the end of the year. We'll just let those other 100 cases go. So I thought that was exquisite timing, considering I didn't necessarily bring that up myself. So many other people did. I'm not suggesting they dumped this probe simply because I took a plea, but it is it's exquisite timing, I must say that. But in terms of talking about what I did or didn't do, I'm still facing, being sentenced by the California Parole Board and doing time. I had to accept doing time to simply ensure the fact that I have a future, and that's because anybody will tell you, even the prosecution, that going before a jury is a dangerous proposition. You can have the best case in the world and at the wrong time or for any reason. And that's the wonderful thing about the jury system, is that perhaps you can get an acquittal, but on the other hand, you can also get the opposite.
We're talking to Sarah Jane Olson and her attorney, Sean Chapman, this just after. Well, you went into court in an unusual hearing, and this was the second hearing. I wanted to ask what you think of the judge's statement, the integrity of the criminal justice system demands, and the public confidence in it demands, that Olson make a choice. She cannot have it both ways. Then you having to go back into court made your statement to the judge on Tuesday. I did not make the bomb, you said, denying direct role in a bomb attempt to place a bomb under two police cars. You said, I did not make the bomb, I did not possess that bomb, I did not plant that bomb, but under the concept of aiding and abetting, I plead guilty. Fiddler then pressed you further, because you are in fact guilty, and you responded, yes.
Well, I had no choice. I didn't want to do that, but I really had no choice. This is a high-profile case, and people plead guilty to charges all the time, as you well know, for all kinds of reasons. Usually they involve just simply having something sure, like a sentence that you know there's an end to, or saving friends and family more anguish, or just not having enough money, all of which applied to me. And I think that if this weren't a case that was commented on afterwards so much in the press, because in the media generally, because it had some attention, mainly because the DA was bringing in Patricia Hearst, and I think that's the only reason this case ever got any comment. You know, it's just another American soap opera. They never ask why people really make decisions. They do at some time in life. They just want to know who's going to bed with who, and that's what I think this was all about, basically. But, you know, it was a high-profile case, and I had to go in and do my penance for telling the truth as I saw it, and I shouldn't have done that. I was bad. And so I did it because even though it irked me, my attorneys are correct. It was the right decision probably to make. It's one of those things you never really know, but it's the decision we made, and we made them through arduous hours of these decisions of conversation and debate and anguish, and it wasn't something we just did overnight. Sean worked so hard for this, and I think afterwards felt a little terrible because it was so obvious, as the affidavit she and Stuart Hanlon and Sidney Crickard, another attorney in her office, and Mark Shattuck, the forensics expert on my case, said in their affidavits that we put on the court record that the DAs really had negotiated in bad faith and throughout the entire thing. And they really had nothing to say about it. They said that the affidavits made them feel uncomfortable. Well, at least that, I would hope. But, you know, it's a dead story now. Who cares? Now we're on to the next thing. And they got what they wanted, and I gave it to them because I'm just one person, and I don't have any power, and I really had to preserve some future for myself.
Well, Sarah Jane Olson, I want to thank you for being with us, along with your lawyer, Sean Chapman. If people want to get more information on your case, where can they go on the web?
www.sarahjaneolsondefense.com or .org. There's a website there, and it has a tremendous amount of information about my case.
Thank you both again. And this news on the home front: the Pacifica National Board appears to have backed out of a mediated negotiation with plaintiffs who are suing the board for alleged illegal conduct, including severing accountability to local advisory boards, changing the bylaws, and hiding network finances. Last week, board members Bob Farrell and Marion Berry, the former D.C. mayor, represented the Pacifica National Board and mediated talks with the plaintiffs. Both sides announced a settlement had been reached and that the details would be made public within days. Marion Berry went on Pacifica Station KPFA's air and said the war at Pacifica is about to be over. But litigant Carol Spooner announced today that Pacifica has terminated the mediator's services. The Pacifica National Board will be meeting in Washington, D.C. on November 17th and 18th. There are many protesters who are expected to be gathering there as well. And that does it for today's program. Tonight I'll be out at SUNY Stony Brook on Long Island at the Scholar Recital Hall for a speech by Lori Garrett on bioterrorism. Tomorrow, heading out to Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio for a talk on Saturday night in Boston at the Orpheum. And that does it for the program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We broadcast on the web at WBIX.org, democracynow.org, and webactive.com. Thanks to KPFA, Pacifica's first station, KFCF, and also to all the Pacifica affiliates who are running this program. We are Pacifica. Thank you to Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno, who are our hosts at the Firehouse. We're broadcasting on WFMU in New York. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman, going out with David Rovix live in our studio.
They bombed Philadelphia, killed women and children and men. It's an old story, we see it again and again.